This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, October 10th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, a seminal poetic memoir. Lynn Hejinian's book, My Life, was first written in 1978. Hejinian was 37 years old at the time, and the book is made up of 37 prose poems, each with 37 lines. When she was 45, Hejinian expanded the book, lengthening the original prose poems from 37 to 45 sentences and writing 8 more new ones with 45 lines. This modest-sounding little book of experimental autobiography was an important text for the most experimental poets of the era, known as language poets. A few decades later, My Life has become an important text for all of American poetry. On our website, there's a written interview with Lynn Hejinian, conducted by Emily Warren, a poet and the former editor of PoetryFoundation.org, and she joins me now by phone to talk about Lynn Hejinian and to listen to a bit of My Life together. Emily, I've been dipping into My Life, and its abrupt transitions and discontinuities don't seem more difficult than a lot of stuff being written today. What made it so radical in the late 1970s?
Well, I think in the late 1970s, the dominant mode of poetry was confessional and lyrical. And she saw that as a closed text where the author and elements of the work direct a reader toward one meaning.
So we're talking Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton.
Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton and Robert Bly and Denise Levertov, just about everybody writing about themselves.
So she was reacting against confessionalism, but in what way? She just got tired of the emotionalism of confessionalism, or is something else at work?
Well, I think a couple things. She believes that we really don't know ourselves outside of language, and in fact, it is what makes us who we are, and it's through language that we can come to know what we don't know. So for her, writing in this way really is philosophical. It's really putting a lot of pressure on language to reveal how language makes us who we are, and it takes you to the very limits of what you can possibly know.
Everything we say about Lynn Hejinian is going to make her sound very highfalutin and hyper-intellectual, but that's not the case, because My Life is quite down-to-earth and is concerned with everyday life.
It's down-to-earth because she's such a wonderful writer. And I'd always been a little intimidated. It's a long work. There's often no relationship between the sentences. It's sentence after sentence after sentence. It could be a description of something and then a statement about something. But what holds it together are just these, it is about her life. She's looking back at her childhood. She really evokes the time when we were learning language itself, before we knew the names for everything.
So a section we've picked out to listen to is called The Obvious Analogy is with Music. It corresponds to the period when Lynn Hejinian was 5 or 6 years old. Is there anything you think we should know before we listen, beside the fact that this is about 3 minutes long and that there's some traffic noise during her reading that we'll hear?
I'm sure she loved that traffic noise. I think one thing you should listen for is the humor in it.
Yeah.
And I think you should listen to what she is saying about time.
So let's listen to it. This is Lynn Hejinian reading from My Life at San Francisco State University in 1979.
The obvious analogy is with music. It was a mountain creek running over little pebbles of white quartz and mica. Let's say that every possibility waits. Nothing could interrupt those given days. My grandfather was as serious as any general before any battle, though he had been too young for the first war and too old for the second. He carried not a cane but a walking stick, and was silent on his walks, except when he passed a neighbor. And then he tipped his hat and said, morning, if it were before noon, or evening, if it were afternoon, without pausing in his walk, just as nowadays joggers will come to a stoplight and continue to jog in place so as not to break their stride. Then the tantrum broke out, blue, without a breath of air. I lifted the ice cream to make certain no spider was webbed in the cone. Sculpture is the worst possible craft for them to attempt. You could increase the height by making lateral additions and building over them a sequence of steps, leaving tunnels or windows between the blocks, and I did. The shape of who's to come. It should be completed only in the act of being used. While my mother shopped, I stood in produce and ate raw peas. The lovely music of the German violin. Most little children like beer, but they outgrow it. Unseen, just heard, hard to remember. The first grade teacher, Miss Sly, was young, and she might have been pretty, but all the years that she had been named Sly, so had made her. A man knit. I had hit upon an idea. Penny, Buster. A child, meanwhile, had turned her tricycle upside down and was turning the pedal with her hand to make the front wheel spin. The solemn, flickering effects, not knowing what you're doing. In your country, do most of the girls do this? A cold but exhibiting hypothesis. I couldn't get the word butterfly, so I tried to get the word moth. The man with the pinto pony had come through the neighborhood selling rides for a quarter, or as he said, 2 bits. And it was that 2 bits, even more than the pony, that led the children to believe he was a real cowboy and therefore heroic. He was a trainer of falcons, scornful of hunting dogs. The body is a farmer. From the beginning, they had to drive the plow through stone eggs. She pretends she is making popcorn. The boats appeared to have stopped on the water, moving only as if to breathe. It seemed that they had hardly begun and they were already there. We were sticky in the back seat of the car. In the school bathroom, I vomited secretly, not because I was ill, but because I so longed for my mother. Now bid chaos welcome. It requires a committee, all translators. Undone is not done. And could it be musical if I hate it?
That's from a recording made in 1979 at San Francisco State University and archived on Penn Sound, which has many recordings of her readings throughout her career. Now, Emily, she throws so much into this. She begins with her grandfather saying hello to people about, and then she talks about eating ice cream and worrying about a spider in the cone, and then about shopping with her mother, and then about her first grade teacher, Miss Sly. What's going on here? What is she doing?
You're right. There's so much going on in this poem. But you can see how she captures a child's openness and also a lack of judgment to the world. These things happen.
Yeah.
And so she's capturing a child learning about them.
He carried not a cane but a walking stick.
So she's learning how to make distinctions.
And was silent on his walks except when he passed a neighbor. And then he tipped his hat and said, morning, if it were before noon, or evening, if it were afternoon.
That's exactly how a child would see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would never report that he said, it's morning if it were morning.
Mm.
A child would be learning that you say good morning when it's morning. So it's written kind of without affect.
Uh-huh.
And so that becomes funny. Of course you say good morning when it's morning.
Right.
So, but then look at how she finishes sentences.
Just as nowadays, joggers will come to a stoplight and continue to jog in place so as not to break their stride.
So one's a child, one's her thinking as adult, like a child, but by putting them in the same sentence, she's juxtaposing them, and of course they're similar, but of course, they're entirely different, and they have no relation to each other.
And
does that,
really,
make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And it really puts the writing of the poem in the late 1970s when jogging suddenly became very popular and the absurdity of people jogging in place at stoplights waiting to cross the street is quite wonderful. It's a wonderful touch. So it's not just putting you back in the mind of a 5 or 6-year-old girl or person. It's also putting you into the mind of a 37-year-old looking back on what it was like to be a 5 or 6-year-old person.
Right, and it's looking back at how a 5 or 6-year-old person learned how to use language. So there are many references, I haven't counted them, about naming.
The first grade teacher, Miss Sly, was young, and she might have been pretty, but all the years that she had been named Sly so had made her.
And that's what's sad about the power of naming and the power of language to shape us. And then in the next sentence,
a man knit. I had hit upon an idea.
A man mitt. Well, mitt is M-I-T-T, a baseball mitt,
mm-hmm.
and men wore them, not women. And then she said, I had hit upon an idea. So she had come up in playing with language, right? A man mitt with an idea.
And the man mitt refers back to Miss Sly? Is that
well,
what?
Well, no. I mean, that's what her poems do constantly. You'll have the first grade teacher, Miss Sly. There's someone some third person narrating that, right, reporting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, a man mit. I had hit upon an idea. So this constant changing of the subject, it foregrounds the language. It makes the process of writing more important than the actual meaning. But it's delightful.
I couldn't get the word butterfly, so I tried to get the word moth.
Yeah, what
you know,
is it?
As a kid, she couldn't
spell it, or she couldn't get it in her classroom.
Who knows?
But who knows, right? You have to,
yeah.
As a reader, you have to invent the details that support that statement.
Right. They thought he was a cowboy, and therefore heroic, and so suddenly there's the cultural reference.
The man with the pinto pony had come through the neighborhood selling rides for a quarter, or as he said, 2 bits. And it was that 2 bits, even more than the pony, that led the children to believe he was a real cowboy and therefore heroic.
So when you're reading a poem like this, and you, obviously it's part of a larger work and you have a sense of it by the time you're going through it, but what surprised you the most and gave you the most pleasure reading this particular prose poem?
One of the things I love about the work in general and in this poem too is even though it's so disjunctive and it's one sentence after another, some of those sentences are assertions. And an assertion is a statement of truth or facts. So she will often put in a statement of fact or an assertion of truth, and it makes you look at the nature of truth, that that's how we decide something's true.
The body is a farmer. From the beginning, they had to drive the plow through stone eggs.
So as a child, maybe the stones in a field are stone eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But the body is a farmer. How wonderful is that? It's true. The body is a farmer. New life grows out of it. But immediately you think about a farmer with a plow. And then at the very end of the poem, she says,
undone is not done.
Done is a word about completion. I'm done with that.
Mm.
And when we say, I'm undone, it means we've come undone.
We've fallen apart.
We've fallen apart. Our mind is gone. And in this case, she says, undone is not done. And so you can see how words accrue cultural meanings, but they become colloquial. They become metaphors. And that's the second to the last sentence. And then the next one is,
and could it be musical if I hate it?
And so she's asking the question right after an assertion, which is really funny. And unlike most of her poems, referring back to the beginning, which is the obvious analogy, is with music.
Right.
She's always setting you up, right? It's like she's the comic and you're the straight person.
Uh-huh.
So the obvious analogy is with music. So that's something highfalutin and somebody talking about poetry and saying, you know, it's analogous to music. Poetry is language at its most musical, and poetry aspires to be musical without the music. So she says that, and then the very first sentence is,
it was a mountain creek running over little pebbles of white quartz and mica.
That's a beautiful lyrical moment. It's what you'd find in a confessional poem where you have a deep image. And it's an analogy to music. So the world, the physical natural world, is like music, and we think, ah, yes, a stream or a creek is like music. But then the very next thing is,
let's say that every possibility waits.
So she's making a conjecture. And then,
nothing could interrupt those given days.
She's back to childhood and perceiving. And what's not in the poem we heard, but is in the version with 45 sentences, she says, but nothing could interrupt those given days. I was sipping Shirley Temple's, wearing my Mary Jane's. So Shirley Temple and Mary Jane's are names of cultural icons at the moment. So immediately it's about naming. In writing in that way and kind of triggering you to think about your own childhood, it's very freeing.
Mm.
You don't have to think, oh, you know, my mother said that and that made me X and how upsetting that is.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Emily.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great to talk to you, Curtis.
You can read more prose poems by Lynn Hajinian and her essay, The Rejection of Closure, on the Poetry Foundation's website, where you can also sample poems by Emily Warren. Emily Warren's latest book is Shadow Architect. If you have any comments on this program, email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.